Good evening, everybody. Let's cultivate our motivation. And so let's look at our wish to have happiness in samsara and how we go to all lengths and do everything we possibly can to get this happiness, whether it's happiness from material possessions, from relationships, from status, from popularity, whatever it is, that beauty, athletic skill, and how we go, do we do so many things? We have to work very hard to arrange the circumstances so that we can have what we think will make us happy. And just think in your life how much time and energy you've spent doing that. How much effort you have to do to arrange things to have the happiness you want, and how many quarrels you've gotten into with people so that you can get the conditions to have the external things and people that you want. Just reflect on that in your life. And yet, when we've gotten what we've wanted, the relationships or the time to spend at a place or the possessions or the beauty or abilities or whatever, has any of that really brought us genuine satisfaction? Has it ever really satisfied our deeper needs for purpose and meaning in our lives? And so when we consider that deeply and see that those things haven't brought lasting fulfillment or satisfaction, then it may make us question how we set our priorities for the future and how we're willing to spend our time and resources. So think about that a bit. And instead, let's shift our priorities to cherishing others instead of cherishing ourselves. And think of the long-term happiness and satisfaction that brings to others as well as to ourselves. and seeing the benefit of cherishing others, let's generate love and compassion and bodhicitta, which will propel us to seek full awakening for their benefit. And so generate that as the motivation for being together this evening. Did you feel an energy shift partway through the meditation when you went from thinking about how you spent a lot of time and energy trying to arrange things to get what you want, and then all of a sudden shifting it to, you know, cherishing others? Did your mind feel some change in there? Yeah, my mind did, because I realized that, you know, when I'm sitting there thinking, okay, I want this and I need this and these people don't understand that, you know, this is really important to me and why can't I have it, and they get it but I don't, and I deserve it and they're all mean anyway, and, you know, and thinking of how hard I work to try and get what I want and how really critical I am of other people when they don't seem willing to cooperate with me. And then just the energy in my mind when I'm thinking like that. And then what happens to the energy in my mind when I just put that down and I think, how can I benefit sentient beings? You know, for me, there's a very marked shift in my mental energy. Do you experience that? Yeah. I mean, I really noticed it, and that it jumps out. It, like, when we are sitting there just thinking of, you know, I want this, I need that, how can I get it? They don't want to give it to me, you know, how can blah 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 blah, blah. How actually, what a suffering mental state that is, isn't it? You know, how much we suffer in an attempt to get our duckies lined up so that we can get what we think is going to bring us happiness. You know, and that was even before you start talking to these other people and telling them how uncompassionate they are and how stupid they are and everything. Just the energy in our own mind is so unpleasant. Yeah. So it really kind of, when you see that through your own experience, then, you know, then when the teachings talk about the disadvantages of self-centeredness and how it causes us suffering, then that becomes very clear. You know, we know it through our own experience. Oh, yeah. You know, when I was really stuck on this and I was doing da da dee da doo hoo to get it, whoa, you know, I was really pretty miserable. And the moment I put it down, you know, I put my wants, needs, opinions, ideas, you know, all this stuff down and just approach life with an open slate with how can I be a benefit, then the mind is so much more relaxed, you know. And somebody asks you to wash the floor, okay, I'll wash the floor. And somebody asks you to, you know, I don't know, clean the kitty litter box. And you go, sure. And yeah, it's like the mind is so much more at ease. It's so much more at ease. So I think that's a good thing to try and remember, you know, especially when our mind is getting tight and we're beginning to see our relationships with other people as power struggles, you know. They're trying to control me. They won't let me do this. Yeah. Yeah? You see things as power struggles? Mm, some people are gone. Yeah. How tight, how really unpleasant that kind of mental state is. Okay. So, last week, Venerable Tarpa gave, I heard, quite a nice talk about the three principles of the path and how they related to the three capacities of beings. And there is a chart illustrating that in Guided Meditation on the Stages of the Path. And so I think it's very helpful if, you know, you can look at that chart, because then it explains it very succinctly, and it's very helpful to understand that, because when you know that, then you know when you hear different topics of Dharma talks, where it fits on the path and how it's, you know, related to the other topics. And I think that's very important, especially nowadays where people very seldom have the opportunity actually to get a series of teachings over a period of time. You know, you find in most Dharma centers a teacher will come a weekend, a week, you know, usually not so much longer, and you get a whole bunch of teachings at one time. And so you get this subject this time, and that subject that time, and another subject another time. And you're left saying, oh, how do all of these fit together? How do I put them into one practice? How do they relate? They seem so different, you know? One time I'm told that, you know, cherishing others is the way to enlightenment. Then I'm told that reciting 100,000 mantras is the way to enlightenment. And then I'm told that meditating on death is really important. And I don't know what to do, you know? And then also I can make these satsas. And how does that fit in? Yeah? So when you have an idea of, you know, the stages of the path and the three principles and, you know, what the motivation is for each level of practitioner and what meditations you do to get that motivation, what meditations you do after you get that motivation to actualize what that motivation is seeking. You know, when you have an idea about that, then when you hear different topics, you know where they go, you know, and it's not so confusing. That's not to say that I think, you know, short bits of teachings here and there is the ultimate way for a Dharma education. No, I think it's much better if you can take teachings over a period of time and really, you know, go through something and learn it in depth. But first you have to have a general overview before learning anything in depth makes any sense. Okay, so last time, when I was talking, we were talking about the three capabilities of beings, and so we talked about the first capability of being, you know, and that kind of had three subdivisions. You remember?
The type of practitioner that just uses, doesn't even attempt to use the Dharma, so just tries to get the happiness of this lifetime through external objects. Mm-hmm. Then there's a type of practitioner that tries to use the Dharma to achieve happiness of this lifetime. And then there's a type of practitioner that tries to use the Dharma to attain happiness of future rebirths.
Yeah. Okay, so there's those three. The person who's just seeking the happiness of this life and uses ordinary methods to get it. The person who's seeking just the happiness of this life, they use ordinary methods sometimes, and sometimes they use the Dharma, but their purpose is, you know, basically calm the mind, you know, get rid of so much anxiety, things like that. And then the last person of the first scope, who uses the Dharma to try and create the causes for a future life. So this Buddhist teachers conference that I went to last week, it was quite interesting. During one of the exercises, they asked, and these are Buddhist teachers, they asked, You know, if you believe in rebirth, kind of go to this side of the room. It was just kind of seeing the, you know, to see the diversity. So a bunch of people, myself and Bhikkhu Bodhi included, we went to that side of the room. And then there's an awful lot of people staying who didn't move. And then there's some people, because they had put a tape, you know, to separate the sounds, who were straddling the tape. Yeah, it was very surprising. And then they asked, they put us all back on one side of the room, and then they said, if you believe literally in, you know, other realms, heavenly realms, hell realms, and something, go over here. So Bhikkhu Bodhi and I went over there, and some other people went, enough, you know, another people. And then there's still an awful lot of these Buddhist teachers who are not moving, and a few who are kind of on the line. It was fascinating to see. Yeah. And then they asked, how many of you think enlightenment is possible? Then everybody goes across. Yeah. I found it quite really interesting, you know? Because I, you know, I don't like to push rebirth on anybody, you know? And people have to, you know, have freedom just to think about it and contemplate it and see if it makes sense for them. But I was thinking, you know, if I didn't believe in rebirth, how would enlightenment make sense to me? You know? And, yeah. But it's interesting just to see how different people put different things together in their mind and how different this generation of Western Buddhist teachers is from their Asian counterparts who, you know, probably all of them really accept past and future lives. Yeah. Quite different, huh? So you can see that even amongst people who are attracted to Buddhism, just to attain that first level of motivation using the Dharma to prepare for future lives, you know, for some people that becomes difficult because of the views they hold. They don't believe in rebirth, or they don't believe in different realms. And for the rest of us who do believe in those things, that becomes difficult because the appearance of this life is so strong and our attachment to this life and the happiness of this life is so strong. Yeah? So to really, when it comes to making decisions, and, you know, whenever we're weighing the pros and cons of a certain decision, to really take future lives into consideration when we do that. And how much do we do that? You know, because if we take future lives into consideration, it influences the actions we do. So it influences karma is actions. It influences the karma we create and the imprints we're putting on our mind stream. Mm-hmm. Okay. Then the middle level of practitioner is somebody who says attaining a good rebirth in samsara is very good, but you're still stuck in the cycle of samsara, you know, and again being born under the, you know, control of afflictions and karma. And so that person seeks liberation from cyclic existence. You know, that's their motivation. Now, somebody who seeks liberation from cyclic existence, does that mean that they no longer seek a good rebirth in cyclic existence? No. You know, they can still seek a good rebirth in cyclic existence, but their motivation is that in order to attain Nirvana, I need good rebirths in which I can practice, because even at the very best, let's say somebody who enters who's following the hearer path, they need at least three lifetimes to create the merit to attain Nirvana. So even if you're on that person, you know, then you at least need three lifetimes, you know, and that's from the time that you generate complete renunciation. And so you can see that even if you seek nirvana as your final end, your final goal, that in the meantime you need good rebirths. So, you know, the cause of good rebirths is observing the law of the functioning of karma, actions and their effects. And so trying to create virtue, to, you know, abandon non-virtue and to purify any non-virtue we may have created. Okay? So the person who wants release from cyclic existence still does that practice. Yeah, they're dedicating all their merit for release from cyclic existence. Yeah, but they know that a byproduct of dedicating it that way is to get good rebirths in which they can practice. Okay, and they know that there's certain kind of karmic activities that we have to undertake in order to get really good rebirths in which we can continue to practice. So, for example, to have an upper rebirth, like a human rebirth, we need to practice very good ethical conduct. You know, so that person will do good, you know, keep good ethical conduct. When we're practicing the Dharma, we need to have enough, you know, physical things to sustain us. If we're impoverished, it's difficult to practice. So they also practice generosity, knowing that that creates the cause, you know, for that. If they want to meet the Dharma in future lives, then they know that respecting the Dharma in this life is very important. And, you know, taking care of the Sangha community is very important. And listening to teachings and so on, getting as much Dharma contact as you can in this life is very important to create the cause to meet a teacher and the teachings and everything in future lives. Okay? So although this person is seeking nirvana and dedicating everything for that, they are also creating the necessary causes for a precious human life, or at least, or a, you know, a rebirth in the God realm where they can continue to practice. Okay? Okay, then the advanced level practitioners, they say, well, you know, a good human rebirth is good, but, you know, you're still in samsara. And nirvana for myself alone is great, but, you know, that too is kind of limited, because what about everybody else? You know, because that person sees that everything they have or know or do or anything is, you know, exists in dependence upon the efforts and kindness of others. And so that person seeks not simply to liberate themselves from cyclic existence, but to purify all of their defilements, develop all of their qualities to the utmost limitless amount, ability, so that they can become a fully enlightened Buddha and lead others to liberation. Okay? So that person is, you know, still going to create the causes for a good human rebirth, because it's going to take them even longer to actualize their goal. It's not just three lives. It's going to be, following the Bodhisattva path, three countless great eons. Yeah, so it's going to take a while, and you need some good rebirths for that. Mm-hmm. Now, I talk to some people who say, you know, when I hear three countless great eons, I get so discouraged because it takes so long, you know. And okay, the tantric path is quicker, yes, but even, you know, to practice tantra, you don't do tantra because you feel discouraged over practicing for three countless great eons. You do tantra because your bodhicitta is so strong you can't bear others' suffering any longer. Okay? But, you know, what about people who get discouraged when they think, oh, yeah, three countless great eons, You know? And then they feel like they just want to give up the Dharma. And I always wonder about that attitude, because if you've really believed, if you really at the beginning have the Buddhist worldview with rebirth and karma and all these kinds of things, why would you ever give up practicing the Dharma? You know, if you really had solid conviction in those things, then why would you give up practicing? Because you would see that, you know, practicing is your only hope for any respite from you know, horrible misery. Yeah? And so when I hear people say, oh, it's just, I feel so discouraged, and then I wonder, well, what are they going to do then? You know, kind of give up practicing the Dharma and then do what? Go and play tennis? You know? Read People magazine? You know, go to the bar or stay at home and drink or smoke? You know? It's kind of as if they've gotten mad at the Dharma because it takes three countless great eons, as if the Dharma had any control, you know, as if somebody made up this path and made it wrong, yeah, which is certainly not the case. Okay, and I find it interesting when I meet people who just feel, oh, it's so discouraging, because for me, I feel, okay, three countless great eons, I mean, that's sure an awful long time, but I feel a great deal of satisfaction in knowing that at least I'm going in the right direction. You know, if nothing else, I'm making my life meaningful and I'm going in the right direction. And that itself brings a certain amount of satisfaction in life. You know, whether I attain enlightenment in this lifetime or not is another issue. Yeah? And who's to say whether I will or not? And I don't want to arrive at my deathbed and say, oh, I worked so hard and I didn't get enlightenment, so screw Dharma, and then die. I don't want to do that. That's not going to be very helpful. You know? So I just naturally feel, you know, as I just feel like, wow, I am so fortunate to have met the Dharma to start with and to have met the teachers that I have. I mean, how in the world did I meet teachers like this and have the opportunity to practice? And, even I'm not making full use of this opportunity, I'm doing something. And so there's some satisfaction. And, okay, it takes, you know, some more rebirths and, you know, being an adolescent for, you know. Somebody told me when they thought of, you know, three countless great eons, each rebirth being an adolescent again, that they really decided they want to speed the half up a bit. You know, that's what really gave them renunciation. Yeah. So, you know, that idea is not so great. But it's okay, you know, adolescence is impermanent. You get over it at some point. Maybe when you're 50. Yeah, and anyway, you know, I just feel like, wow, I'm so fortunate to do even the little bit I'm doing. And, you know, the goal is it'll come about when it wants. I don't have to be so goal-oriented. It's more about being process-oriented. You know, we keep on talking about attaining enlightenment, achieving enlightenment, you know, attaining realizations. But I think really it's much more accurate to think of the process of practice rather than getting the results. And that's difficult for our goal-oriented culture, in which we always measure things in terms of, here's your aim, the result you want, and did you make it or not? You know? And we don't care you did it honestly or dishonestly. That doesn't matter. Just do it, you know? Whereas Buddhism is really much more about the process. You know, and it's about internal cultivation, and it's about self-transformation. And you know, how are we going to get to be a Buddha if in the process we can't create some states of happy, fulfilled, satisfied mind? You know? So I think we have to learn how to do that. Yeah. Okay. So the people who practice according to the middle level capacity, they attain what's called arhatship or foe destroyer. It's called foe destroyer because they have destroyed the foes of afflictions, ignorance, polluted karma, the foes that cause cyclic existence. That's why it's called foe destroyer. Okay, and then those who are following the Bodhisattva path, according to the advanced level of practitioner, if you follow the Sutrayana path, it takes you 3 countless great eons. If you follow the Tantrayana path, it can be shortened, but you have to work harder. Yeah. And so again, we don't like that. It's like, well, why didn't they make the path, you know, so you don't have to work so hard? It's like our minds thinking like God created this, or a people created it, and why didn't they create it differently? And that's certainly not the case at all. You know, nobody created the path. Buddha just described it. Okay? Okay, so that is a little bit of an introduction to the 3 levels of being. The people who practice the middling level, who strive to become arhats, they still cultivate love and compassion. Not great love and great compassion, but they do cultivate love and compassion. And I emphasize that because sometimes you hear people who follow the Mahayana and they have completely the wrong idea that people who practice the here and solitary realizer vehicle have absolutely no love and compassion at all. And that's completely incorrect, you know. And I remember one time, you know, one of my dear Dharma friends who's done incredible amount of study, and we were at a program. Actually, His Holiness was teaching, and they had different speakers in the evening, and one person from the Theravada tradition talked about the meditation on metta, or maitri, you know, loving kindness. And my friend was so shocked. Oh, these people meditate on love. I never knew this. Mm-hmm. You know? And this is the kind of ignorance that we often have about other traditions and other paths. So I think it's important to know. Yeah? And also to note that what we call Theravada is not equal to the hearer vehicle or the solitary realizer vehicle. That even in Theravada scriptures, there's a presentation of the Bodhisattva path. Yeah? There was a 6th century sage, Dharmamitra? Dharmananda? Oh, I should remember his name. Dharma somebody, and maybe Dhammananda, and he wrote a whole text on the Bodhisattva path from the Theravada viewpoint. Yeah? So we shouldn't equate Theravada with the hearer vehicle or solitary realizer vehicle. Okay? Then the people who are at the advanced capacity, those are usually people who practice Mahayana, and they have the motivation to attain Buddhahood, and they cultivate the great love and the great compassion and the realization of emptiness. But not everybody who calls themselves a Mahayanist is actually one. Yeah? If I ask myself, do I have the bodhicitta of a bodhisattva? The answer is no. You know, so maybe I should say I'm an aspiring Mahayanist. Something like that. Okay. But no reason to be arrogant about these things. And I'll talk about the term Hinayana too. We'll see it a little bit later in this text. That term should be banished. It was a term that evolved later on, after, not with the initial appearance of the Mahayana text, but later on. And it is translated as like lower vehicle, with a negative connotation that those people don't have the great love and great compassion and the bodhicitta that the Mahayanas have. Okay, that they're selfish. And that kind of way of looking at other Buddhist practitioners in this day and age is not very helpful. Okay, and so I've noticed that His Holiness Dalai Lama, when he teaches, and for many years he's done this, is he uses the term fundamental vehicle to talk about the hearer and solitary realizer path, not Hinayana. Yeah, because the fundamental vehicle is something actually that everybody has to practice. On the basis of that, then some people can practice Mahayana. And on the basis of Mahayana, then they can practice Vajrayana. You know, so actually a Vajrayana practitioner practices fundamental vehicle and universal vehicle. And so also it's not correct to call Tibetan Buddhism Vajrayana. And I saw this too at the conference that I went to. There is Vipassana, Zen, and Vajrayana. And those are completely nonsensical categories. First of all, because Vipassana is a meditation technique that's found in all the Buddhist traditions. The Tibetan Buddhists also have Vipassana meditation. Second of all, Zen, you know, if you're talking about general Mahayana, it's not only Zen, yeah? There's Huayan, there's Tentai, there's so many other schools, there's Pure Land School, and Vajrayana is a subset also of Mahayana teachings. It's not, you know, a separate path or doctrine from fundamental vehicle in Mahayana. Yeah, it's surprising to me at a conference of Western Buddhist teachers that these kinds of things are not clarified for people. Yeah? And, you know, so Tibetan Buddhism is not just Vajrayana. You can be a Tibetan Buddhist and not take tantric initiation at all. Yeah? Because there's a whole Sutrayana path explained in Tibetan Buddhism. And you can do that, and it's wonderful. Okay, so I think, you know, use the term fundamental vehicle, if you want to, universal vehicle. But let's not see them as separate and cut off, you know, because they're very, very related to each other. Okay, now again, before we get into the text per se, a little bit more background. I wanted to talk about how this, the text of the grounds and paths fits into the monastic education program as done at least in the Gelu monasteries. I'm not sure exactly at what point it comes in the other monasteries, the other schools. Okay, but when you first enter the monastery, you do a series of texts called collected topics, which means miscellaneous stuff you need to know to go on to the next stuff. Okay? And so you learn the basic debating terminology and things like that. Then you also study low rig or mind and awareness. And this talks about the different types of mind. It also talks about mind and mental factors, kind of like a Buddhist psychology course. It's quite interesting. And then you also study some principles of logic and reasoning so that you know how to make syllogisms and form correct syllogisms with correct reasons, you know, because you're going to need that for all the debating that, that you do in the future things. Then when you get down to the five topics that you seriously study, the first one is the perfection of wisdom. And here, you know, usually when we think of perfection of wisdom, we think of emptiness, you know, because that's the explicit topic that's being discussed. But the implicit topic is all the bodhisattva practices, okay? So the Tibetan term for that, that course is parchin, which just means the far-reaching attitudes, you know, or far-reaching practices or perfections, however you want to translate it as. And parchin usually lasts for about 5 years, and you principally study the all the different bodhisattva practices, and in, according to how it's explained in Abhisamaya Alankara, or Ornament of Clear Realizations. Okay, so to study that text, it's very helpful to understand the paths and grounds according to the Svatantrika Madhyamaka school, because the parchin texts are usually explained according to the Svatantrika Madhyamaka school. Because that's the way the comment, the people who wrote the major commentaries on Abhisamaya Alankara wrote, were Svatantrika Madhyamakas. So they explain it in that way. Okay. Like when we study Dura, the collected topics, that's usually according to the Sautantrika view, because the people who wrote those texts in ancient India, you know, that was their specialty, and they presented it according to that view. So that's why in Tibetan Buddhism, you learn the different views of the different tenet systems when you study these different texts. Okay. After you do you know, the parchin class, then you go to Uma. Uma means middle way or Madhyamaka, and there you will study often Lekshe Nyingpo, the Essence of Good Explanation by Jay Rinpoche. You study Chandrakirti Supplement. Yeah, you study Nagarjuna, so the middle way view. Okay, and so when you do that, it's very helpful to know the paths and grounds according to the Prasangika view, because Uma, the Uma class, is taught according to the Prasangika philosophical system. Okay. Then the next topic you learn is reliable cognition, and you usually study Dharmakirti's commentary on Dinaga's treatise on reliable cognition. So it's Dharmakirti's text is called Pramanavartika. And that one is written according to the Chittamatra view. So there it's helpful to know the paths and grounds according to the Chittamatra view. Then after that, you usually study Abhidharmakosha, which was by Vasubandhu, and he usually writes according to the Vaibhasika view. And you don't do a whole lot of debate when you study Abhidharmakosha, which is Treasury of Knowledge. And then at the end, you study Vinaya, the monastic discipline. And the Tibetans have this little way of ha-ha-ha asking why Vinaya is studied at the end when, you know, you've already been a monk for, you know, so many years. And so they tell us, they say, well, the monks say when I had the precepts, I didn't know Vinaya. And once I learned Vinaya, I realized I didn't have the precepts any longer. Ha 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 ha. I've never gotten the ha 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 part, you know? But they all love saying that. But, you know, when you're in a Chinese monastery or a Theravada monastery, you learn Vinaya at the very beginning. Yeah? Because Vinaya forms the structure in which you conduct your whole monastic life. Yeah. When we've asked His Holiness more about this, he says that I think maybe initially the idea was that you do all these topics when you're still young, so you have the novice ordination, and then by this time you study Vinaya, then you take your full ordination. But in the monasteries, this is anywhere from a 12 to 20 year educational program, so the monks usually have their full ordination long before that. Okay. And up until about 20 years ago, the nuns didn't do this study, and then due to His Holiness's encouragement, the nuns now have the philosophical studies and the debating, and they're doing quite well. And there's the first Geshe, female Geshe. Okay. Okay, then a little bit about the benefits of studying the Paths and Grounds text. So, some people, I found when we were studying this at Nalanda, when I was studying with Geshe Jampa Tekcho, some people really didn't like the philosophical studies. They found it too heady and too boring and like that. But I actually found them quite interesting because for me, learning all these grounds and paths was tremendously inspiring. It was like, oh, wow, here's a roadmap of how you do it. You know, I don't have to feel like the blind leading the blind. You know, here it is. And they say, first you see, you know, when you're driving on the path, first you see this, and then you see this, and then you see this. And so you begin to see that if you're seeing these things in a proper structure, that you're doing something right, you know. And they also tell you in the Paths and Grounds text kind of, in an abbreviated form, but what practices you need to do to see those different things, you know, those different signposts, yeah, on your road to enlightenment. And so I found it like very, very interesting, because to me it was like laying out what, you know, okay, now I have a much better idea of what I have to do. Otherwise you think, you know, oh, attain enlightenment, you just generate bodhicitta and realize emptiness and you got it. You know, renunciation too, but maybe we can bargain about that, skip over the renunciation, because, you know, who really wants to renounce anyway? you know, I mean, we're really so foolish sometimes. To see exactly how to go about it. So I found that quite inspiring because it just clarified things. And so it gives you some idea of, I know I haven't even entered the first path, but, you know, well, someday when I enter the first path, then I'll know kind of, okay, you know, here's where I am and I still need to cultivate these things and, you know. And so it makes it all very clear, which I think is very nice. And it also makes it very inspiring because you think, even if I haven't done that, other people have. You know, all these paths and grounds that they're describing, other people have actualized. So there's actually people in this universe who have these realizations. And to me, it's like, wow, far out. You know, even I'm not one of them, just the fact that there's people with these kinds of realizations hanging out, I think is great. It means that all isn't hopeless in life. You know, because before I met the Dharma, nothing seemed to make sense. Everything seemed completely meaningless in the long run, you know. But when you think about, why are they talking about these paths and grounds? It's because there's some people who have these realizations. Then it's like, wow, you know, what a way to live your life and make your life meaningful and do something useful and beneficial. And there's people who have done it and they're still hanging out. And maybe I'll meet some of them, even though they don't wear name tags and identify themselves, you know. Maybe I'll be able to meet some of them and receive some teachings from them or some, you know, a good example from them. So I find that very inspiring. Okay? Other things is it shows you, it helps you to identify very clearly what are the things you need to abandon on, you know, to get to enlightenment. You know, assuming here we're following the Bodhisattva vehicle, aiming for full awakening. You know, what things do we need to abandon? So it's very clear, you know, here's the list of mental factors that prevent you from attaining enlightenment. And these are the parts of the mind that you really have to apply the antidote to and overcome if you want to become a Buddha. And here are other parts of your mind, other mental factors, that you really need to focus on and nourish and enhance and practice and increase if you want to, you know, get to awakening. So it clearly identifies, you know, what to eliminate, what to practice. Yeah, and it also talks about the techniques for doing it, you know. And, you know, where does concentration fit into all of this? Where does realization of emptiness and, you know, renunciation and bodhicitta, where do they all fit into this? Yeah, and do I abandon all my anger all at once? Or do I abandon my anger gradually? Do I develop compassion whammo? All at once, or do I develop gradually? So it explains this kind of thing, yeah. So it very clear roadmap. It also gives us the fact that there all are beings who have actualized all these paths and grounds, lets us know that it's possible to live without afflictions. You know, sometimes we just feel like, my mind is such a mess. There's nothing I can do. There's no way out of this. Yeah. But then if you really think about the paths and grounds and you think, well, wait a minute. There's people who have practiced and they've eliminated different degrees of afflictions. So it's actually possible to do that. And it's possible to live a life that is free of afflictions. Wow. You know, and talk about hope. I mean, doesn't that give you a lot of hope in your life to know that that's possible? You know, and for me, even if that's like a few eons down the line, just to know it's possible just completely turns around the way I look at life and gives a tremendous sense of hope and optimism. You know? Okay, and then another benefit is it gives us faith that the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas actually exist, because the path to those states is clearly laid out and it made sense. Yeah, and so again, you know, when we sit there and, you know, is it possible to attain Buddhahood? You know, that seems like so far off, so this and that, you know, and you have a lot of doubts about it. Studying the paths and grounds can give you some conviction. What really gives you the conviction that Buddhahood exists is studying emptiness and realizing emptiness, you know. Because when you have a good understanding of emptiness, then you understand really how it's possible to eliminate the afflictions and how that works. Okay, but the paths and grounds can give you a lot of inspiration along that line too, you know. And I think it's very important when we're practicing to have a mind that's inspired. You know, otherwise Dharma practice just seems so dreary, you know. And we hear the word renunciation, and we think, oh, renunciation, what suffering. Actually, we're renouncing suffering. Renunciation is joyful. We're not renouncing happiness, we're renouncing misery. So, you know, we should have a happy mind when we practice. Yeah. And that's why I think, you know, we've been talking about expectations, unrealistic expectations. They're a real pain in the neck. You know, they really get in the way of practicing. And self-deprecation also is a big hindrance, you know.
Explain
self-deprecation, putting ourselves down.
Oh.
Yeah. You don't do that, so that's why you didn't know the word.
Why did I ask that question?
It's because I'm so stupid. And I'm hopeless. And I can't practice this path anyway. Yeah. Okay. So, you know, I think we have to be on the big lookout against, you know, unrealistic expectations and self-deprecation. Because both of those are really, really big hindrances. Okay, and we may be so used to deprecating ourselves that we don't even realize we do it because we think it's reality. And we may be so used to having unrealistic expectations that, again, we don't have the clue that they're unrealistic. We think they're actually possible. And then, you know, when we're not enlightened by next Tuesday, we're, you know, really down in the dumps. Well, maybe next Wednesday, you know, extend it for a day. Okay. Also, when we study the paths and grounds in terms of the sutra yana practice, then it really helps us appreciate the tantrayana procedure of practice, because we see where the three countless great eons fit in the sutrayana, what practices are done in each countless great eon, and then you can see how the tantra way of practicing shortens the time necessary to gain certain realizations due to specific skillful techniques that are employed in tantra. Okay. Questions? We have just a couple of minutes. Yeah.
I don't think I follow the big picture in one way.
Mm-hmm.
When you were talking about the five top main topics,
mm-hmm.
Study the monasteries,
mm-hmm.
Do they study the paths and grounds in those first three, in these different perspectives?
Oh, okay. Usually you study the paths and grounds before you study Parchin.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. You do that at the beginning, and they'll usually do it according to the Svatantrika Madhyamaka view. Yeah. And then when you learn Prasangika, then everything gets jumbled up again. Okay. What I do know is that in the other traditions, like in the Gelu, for each of these five topics, they principally emphasize one text, and they go into that one text very, very deeply. In the Nyingma, they'll do the same topics, but they'll read much more widely. Okay? So they won't go into one text as deeply, but they will read more widely, and so have a number of perspectives on those different topics.
So they actually study it, some kind of salam text before they do the five.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Rinpoche, okay.
So for those of us, you know, young, middle-aged, and old who are practicing the Dharma and all up at the Vinaya part of this,
mm-hmm.
How do we, you know, the progression along the path as far as the philosophical tenets, I mean, we learn a lot when our teachers come and you've taught us, but we don't have things laid out in our paradigm here as far as learning the Dharma with this type of in-depth knowledge. So how do we adapt this to,
oh, okay.
You know, now present when it's still young, and how will that get integrated?
Okay. So how do we adapt this Tibetan educational system with these five principal topics to the West? This is a question that a lot of people are thinking about. One major thing is that the Tibetans often say that while they're studying these philosophical studies, they don't want them to study Lam Rim too much, because when you study Lam Rim, you want to go off and meditate. And if you go off and meditate, you're not going to spend your time doing the philosophical studies. So they also usually don't take... nowadays, they do get some Lam Rim studies, yeah. But they'll often say that you know, that they don't emphasize that. And they usually, the monks don't take tantric initiations either, because when you do the philosophical studies with the debating, you really need a lot of time. And also because they memorize texts, and so you need your time for that, so they usually don't do tantra. A few of them do, but, you know, usually, again, it's discouraged. Now, the question comes, is that educational system, as has been practiced in Tibet for the last however many centuries, appropriate for Westerners? Okay? Because when you enter a Tibetan monastery, you're often 6, 7, 8 years old. Yeah, so you start memorizing all these texts, you start with your first Dura text, and you learn that a white horse isn't white, and so on, you know? But Westerners who come to the Dharma are educated people, you know? They're not like 6, 7, 8-year-olds who are just learning things. So expecting an educated Westerner to kind of follow it in the same way that a 6 or 7-year-old child would, that's not going to pan out. Also, Westerners want something that touches their heart. And while some of us find that the philosophical teachings are very moving, you know, I mean, I was quite different really when I was studying at Nalanda, because I found these teachings very related to my practice. But a lot of the people that I studied with didn't. They thought it was too intellectual. In any case, you know, whether they're intellectual or not, or whether it's your mind or who knows, Westerners really need something that touches their heart. They're, you know, when you're a Tibetan, you're a 6 or 7-year-old kid, your parents put you in the monastery, you grow up that way, you don't ask any questions. You know, now sometimes when they hit adolescence, they start asking questions like, I could make more money if I were selling sweaters in Mumbai, you know. They start asking that. But normally, you know, you just enter and you just do it, and everybody's doing it, and you're living together with people from your own region. Usually there's an uncle who's raising you, or some family member who's raising you, and you just do what everybody else is doing, and you don't ask questions, because in old Tibet, I mean, you didn't have a whole lot of choices about what to do with your life. In the West, you know, people have an education, and why are they coming to the Dharma? It's not necessarily because they want to study philosophy. I mean, if they really wanted to study philosophy, often they major in philosophy in college, you know? So they're coming to the Dharma because they want something to experience, something that touches right here, something that applies to their life, yeah? And so, you know, I think that, you know, Lam Rim approach is much more useful for Westerners, and then bring some of the philosophy into the Lam Rim, yeah, so that you understand how philosophy relates to Lam Rim. But, you know, if you put a Westerner in a Tibetan monastery, you know, Westerners have been practicing Tibetan Buddhism, what now, since the early 70s? How many Western Geshe's do we have? Not many. Why? Why? You know? And I think it's really because Westerners have an internal need, you know, and wish for something that's experiential. And they're not willing to wait until they go through years and years of debating to get to the part where you really get more experiential things. Yeah? Although, like I say, for some people who do the philosophical studies, it's very experiential, and they meditate a lot on it. But, you know, for many people, it doesn't seem that way. Yeah, so I think we need, like, a different kind of way of combining the topics to make it applicable for Westerners who begin Dharma practice as adults. Yes?
Sometime it would be interesting to know what the institutions that have been set up, like Lama Tsongkhapa, you know, what those, how those institutions are established and how what oh. other classes or okay. master's program at Nalanda.
Okay. Okay. Well, they now, like an FPMT, they have the basic program, which is 3 years. The master's program, I think it was initially 7, but some people said it was too long, so they've made it into 5. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so they'll go through these topics, again, picking out the most important mm-hmm. points to learn. And I think most of the people who do that have done some Lam Rim before. Okay? But if you're really skillful and you know the Lam Rim well, then you know where all these topics come in, and you know, if you have a good teacher, they can put in the important topics where it belongs, where they belong in the Lam Rim. Okay.